Thank you so much. This is very exciting. Francis, I really appreciate it. I've been reading your book. I was saying before all of this, we were laughing, that you owe me many units of therapy because of how traumatizing your book is. But that's okay. We're used to it here at the East is a Podcast, of just daily traumatizing memories that will be seared into my brain of like things I learned from your book. But Francis, before we get into that, can you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about who you are and your research.
I guess like it depends, but I teach at Duke University. I'm on leave this term. I'm in Amman, and I just went to Palestine for a bit, for about 18 days, which we'll talk about. I work on gender and sexuality, mostly in the Arab world, and kind of transnational. I consider myself a transnational feminist scholar and very interdisciplinary. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more to say, but I guess that's a good way to start. I'm in addition to this book, which we'll talk about, I'm currently involved with a colleague on a project on feminist theory and imperialism, which, you know, we started it this academic year because it's an interest of mine, the alignments between those two projects, and then where does that actually leave, you know, gender and sexuality movements, liberatory projects that are anti-imperialist, because there's not a lot of space for them. And this is my fourth book that we'll talk about. My first book was on the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, especially its women's committees in the occupied territories, Jordan. And I did field work in like Syria and Jordan and Palestine for that. And then my second book is on marriage and sex. And I looked at the United Arab Emirates and Egypt, and I deal with Islamic law and state laws to just look at new relationship forms. And that's called Consuming Desires, Family Crisis in the State. And then I did a book with a Moroccan colleague, a co-edited volume on the Arab revolutions called Freedom Without Permission, Bodies and Space in the Arab Revolutions. And then we have this book. So I've kind of worked on Egypt, worked on Palestine, did a bit of work on the Gulf, especially the United Arab Emirates. So, I mean, in terms of, you know, social science field work, right? That kind of thing.
Well, I'm excited because I want to also ask you about the DFLP book, but we have a lot to talk about before we get to that, because we should first talk about your trip. You were just in Palestine, and it's quite the moment in Palestine. I just thought we were sort of opening up, and you could give us a sense of, like, I mean, as dumb as this question is, like, what's the vibe there? Like, what's, because it's quite this new Zionist government is pulling out all the stops and terrorizing Palestinians. I mean, what's new? But
yeah.
I guess this is kind of new. I guess in some ways it feels new.
I don't know, Sina. I mean, I've been going to Palestine since 89. I was there in the first Intifada as a pretty young person, and because I wanted to be there. So the way I did this trip is I spent 8 days. It's the way Palestine is organized. I spent about 8 days in Jerusalem, because it's just so difficult. So, and most of those days I was in Jerusalem, except I went to Haifa for 1 day, just on a day trip. And so Jerusalem was just, you know, beautiful as always, but Palestinian, but it's very tense. It's very tense. The old city is always tense. They, you know, basically businesses are barely, they stay for Sumud, but the tourist industry is dominated by the Israelis. And a lot of the property, including the business property, is waqf. And a lot of property.
That's the Jordanian religious authority, right? Jordanian,
I mean, waqf is like exists, right, all over, but yeah, the Jordanians are still in charge of Waqf, and Waqf is all the religions. It's all the religions have, but a lot of businesses, they pass their property generation to generation through Waqf, right? So if it wasn't actually for that, I think that property would be gone. Not that the Israelis have not stolen Waqf. I can't say for sure they haven't, but also the other thing that I learned on this trip is that a lot of tourists, like in large groups, especially the pilgrims that are coming from Europe and the United States, they get told don't shop at the Palestinian shops, don't go to the Muslim shops. So it's just kind of surreal because you have a lot of big groups that are organized, but they don't buy from Palestinians. And yeah, it's heartbreaking. And yet it's also beautiful. And that's how it is outside the old city as well. I love Jerusalem, but it does have these, you know, things that, you know, used to be in the old days, the Hajjat were like, they were in the front of Bab al-Amud, you know, Damascus Gate, that you had like all kinds of things from the village, greens, foods, and there's still a little bit of that, but now there's two really ugly Israeli structures. You know, they're not passing structures; they're physical structures. In my vision, they're not going to be permanent, but there they are in front of Bab al-Amud. And so that's how that Jerusalem was, just like that, where people are just holding and living, you know, also living. And that's the way it always is in Palestine, like these multiple kinds of realities, because, you know, you can't allow them to destroy all dimensions of life. So, and then I went to Haifa with a friend and my son, and that was just like a day trip. And it also has a different, you know, you pass eventually this massive wall that, especially by Qalqilia, and you just like, there's just this reality, you know, Israel and then the other side, the territories occupied in 67 and more than that. And then in Haifa, you know, you really can't say Palestinian. Do you see what I mean? It's like they use the language of Arab, you know, Arabs. But we walk to Wadi Nisnas, which is the Palestinian area. And that was pretty beautiful, just lovely, eating the way they do it in Wadi Nisnas, which is these shabby restaurants. They cook like seven pots of food, different foods, and you kind of buy a plate for the table, as many plates as you want, of the delicious things in the pots. So that was pretty nice, but you know, it's always kind of, it's heartbreaking too. And then I was in Ramallah for the rest of the time, and you know, I saw friends, I saw colleagues, I hung out a lot, and it always feels it's an illusion, but it feels better after you get past all this stuff. It feels less tense than Jerusalem, but it kind of depends. You just have an event, but that's where all the elites are. But there are also a lot of poor people, peasants, farmers, you know, Ramallah and Bira are, they have everything. And then I took a trip up to Nablus because I gave a talk at Najah and university. And I thought, wow, Nablus is great. And so I spent the day in the Khan with a family friend at like the morning before. Then I had this big event, and then afterwards we went out. And I thought, wow, I love Nablus, and it feels different from Ramallah. But of course, you know, you're passing all these just settlers, soldiers. But still, you know, I still felt different than Ramallah. And then a few days later in, you know, daytime, there was that raid, you know, on the Khan, and then like everything, yeah, it changes like that in Palestine. So that's how I would say was, and then I hate the borders. They're terrible for everyone. Unless I think you're Jewish, and I always do the land border, and you, again, it's unpredictable. You don't really know what's going to happen. It's expensive to cross the land border from Jordan. But it was uneventful, relatively. I mean, I still got a little bit of an interrogation, but it was fine.
You know, the what I meant earlier about like whether it's different now, it's not in terms of its relationship to the colonized, like indigenous people of Palestine. Obviously, there has been like a uniform policy of Zionists like across their history, in that's like that treats them a specific way, which is namely as an enemy. That hasn't changed. However, I meant more the fact that the crises of Zionism are beginning to catch up with itself, that its own sort of like its own fictional constitution as this like this unifying space for like this diverse class of one type of people is like that's a crazy contradiction, right? To say that like, oh, we want like plurality but of minority, which is to say like, or we want plurality but of one specificity, meanwhile half the population of that their country supposedly is considered outside of that, right? They're Palestinian Arabs. And so like one of the sort of like pressure valve release points of Zionist sort of politicking is to beat up on the indigenous people and to show and to flex on them and to show how strong you want to go at them, right? Which is also typical for a lot of colonist sort of projects. So that's kind of what I meant. And I think that it's interesting too, the description of the cities that you went to, because in the West Bank is itself divided politically between, say, Ramallah and its sort of other environs, including Jenin, I guess, Nablus, right, where these other political forces are active that aren't the PA, that aren't the sort of like specific Palestinian faction that has been emboldened since Oslo to be like the government of Palestine, but in fact that they're just this elite of the Palestinians whose primary job is to be a kind of comprador force between like Israel, it's, you know, and like, you know, and the Palestinian people that it, you know, colonizes. So anyways, that's a long blah, blah, blah question. Because I think that like, that's kind of where we stand. And the fact that like the sort of like appeal to pogroms, like doing open pogroms, which I think you were there for, you were there during when it was happening, or were you, had
I
you just left
on the 16th. So it feels like, I don't know. You know, some of them all mushed together for me, but I think it happened when I was in Amman, you know, Amman, the like straight call out. I mean, I am not surprised by anything, because what's said publicly was historically done and said privately. Yeah. And then I would just say about Jenin and Nablus, not from extremely high levels of information, but they're also penetrated by the Palestinian Authority. And again, I think this is where political geography and class and all of that really matters to how we understand it. But I remember doing research in a village in 2017 or 2018. I was in Qalqilya, I was around Jenin, I was around Nablus for this book, and just hanging out with young men, like I won't say where, which village, and waiting for my transportation out of the village, and we were chatting, and Islamic Jihad was, you know, like kind of the organization and kind of the umbrella organization for action. So I'm not surprised, you know, that is kind of the umbrella organization for a lot of what's happening, and it's multi-ideological. Islamic Jihad was always different than Hamas in that way. You know, it's not really like Muslim Brotherhood kind of politics, and that does differ. So in Palestine, yeah.
Okay, so I'm trying to think about a way to sort of bridge it to your book, because there's something, the nature of the Zionist colonization of Palestine and how it's unfolded through this era of like historical human development that coincided with this massive leaps in what scholars call biopolitical warfare. Like maybe we'll sort of get into what biopolitics means and all that stuff, but just to ask the question though, is that biopolitical warfare is not new. Every army that has used rape as a weapon is doing kind of some kind of biopolitical violence, even if like we didn't have a name for it. It is a kind of like gendered, like racialized biopolitical violence. However, the tools at the dispense of the sort of violence doers have rapidly changed in this century, and this century of conquest of Palestine, right? Like, I really do like Rashid Khalidi's term of like the 100 years war on Palestine, and beginning with Balfour as like the sort of kickoff of it. That really has been like a powerful, I would love to have him on my show. Actually, I should really ask to get him on my show.
Sure. Can you use your connections? He'll say yes.
Can I do this live?
I think he'll say yes. Yeah.
Okay. I'm honored. I'm, but yeah, this is, but like, I feel that like that has always kind of been a useful kind of framework that like, okay, a century long project. Then of course human power and politics and warfare has evolved during that time. So of course the like strategies of Zionism and also anti-Zionism Palestinians will evolve according to that. However, you know, as your book devastatingly might I add maps. Oh god. I need like a fetus emoji or like sound effect of like, oh, I'm going into the fetal position, because that's what it's like reading some of these chapters of yours. Like, oh boy, this is dark. Even the title itself is so dark, like the origin of your title. But yeah, I was like, wow, she really goes for the jugular. Part of it though is that like the biopolitical nature of Zionist conquest is so violent, and it's had such violent, if not directly, I mean, both directly and indirectly, in terms of its consequences, in terms of its like its attack on, say, even something simple as like poisoning wells, which was like a tool they used in 48 and before, like is an incredibly violent like and strategic like use of biopolitics. So like, Can we sort of get into like the meaning of biopolitics? I come to think of it, I don't think I've done an episode on biopolitics.
So I see this book as, yes, I'm using some Foucauldian, you know, but actually my book on marriage and sex was more about a kind of biopolitics and governmentality of marriage, sex, and family life by modern states. So this is the kind of death part of biopolitics, which I don't remember which it's necropolitics, it's thanatopolitics, you know, just like thinking of the different lectures of Foucault. And then what I did is I really dug in to the archival, the, as you know, many different kinds of archives and many kinds of sources. And I just want to say that a big piece of the book is also British imperialism. And I show that death politics, that thanatopolitics, which during the mandate, you have mostly the coexistence of a Zionist biopolitics focused on cultivating Jewish bodies and babies and bringing in a lot of money from like Australia, New Zealand, the United States, Europe, to invest in Jewish health and babies and mothers and on this, you know, because it was always a demographic question. What's interesting for Palestinians during that time is that I think we often forget that colonization and imperialism is a death politics. It's like somebody's life is being cultivated at the cost of other people's lives. And one thing that came out for me are questions of hunger and disease and their relationship to other diseases and their relationship to death and to shortened life. And I think we forget that because, I mean, the British Empire sets it is relatively successful in some ways at, you know, in certain circles at positing itself as somehow civilized. And when I dug in, I saw that there's just a lot of daily kinds of practices and the daily consequences of policies and practices. And they brought them from India, from Kenya, from Nigeria, and that's all in the documents as well. So that's part of the just questions of hunger. And then the other thing, which is relevant to today and relevant in many places, but especially intensified, you know, during COVID, is investment in austerity, you know, the language of efficiencies and economies and what that meant for Palestinians during the colonial period, the lack of investment. And at the same time that Zionists were investing enormously in cultivating Jewish life and Jewish health, you have an example of the British not doing that. And I build a lot of stories in the book. I know the book is depressing in some ways, but in other ways, it also just tells these stories of conflict around those questions. And a lot of the actors are Palestinian who are fighting. And that's part of the necropolitical or the thanatopolitics. And of course, this just intensifies. But again, we always say Zionism is cut from the cloth of European colonialism and imperialism. I mean, it just is. And so it's a strand of it, one branch of it, exactly. And so but the demographic question is really, you know, like the demographic question is just so central. And part of my book is to make an argument about the demography in the book.
Yeah, so we should get into the, because I mean people listening to this maybe have encountered the term biopolitics. They probably read something about it. If they haven't, it's a useful way of it's a useful sort of shorthand. I mean, as it understanding a lot of it, like all academic things, it's been used and abused to no end. And like, you know, made conferences and whatever, and I'm guilty of this too. Like I'm not outside of this, but like it's interesting, it's a shorthanded. It's a good, useful shorthand to talk about the political investment in life itself. Now, you could say that, oh, that's not new, that like, oh, Romans did that. They cared about life. But it's not about the care of life, but it's that the nature of like the concern of like political anxieties, like seeping their way into like the blood of human beings.
And at the level of populations. Right. So that was, yeah.
Yeah. Individuals and every individual at the same time in dynamics. And you use, and there's a whole sort of like knowledge information system that you have to acquire to speak about these things, to like connect those two. And those connections are themselves like really interesting and vital and whatever, but like also like full of crazy things. But like at the broader though, is that like the classic definition, at least from I'm doing my own archaeology of my own dissertation right now in my head, but it's like basically that like the way that Foucault famously put it was that the, you know, politics before this era of biopolitics, it used to be that, you know, the politics was this, what was it, the state or something, the sovereign would like, was it let live and make die, that like if you bothered the king in some way he would just kill you. And that's it. That's like one relation. And if you didn't bother him, you would just be allowed to live and perish quietly of some disease or whatever, because you're some peasant and who cares about you. And that was like the standard model. Whereas this development in like the 18th, 19th centuries, I guess a little bit sooner too, depending on where you drop the plumb line, is then it's inverted and you make live and let die. right? Is that right? Yeah. Make live and let die. And the idea that death and life-giving are these like political levers that you can pull on populations at any given time, like some that like, you know, and it's either through like direct murder or, and like, you know, all various tools that we have to that end, or slow murder in the form of like concentration camps or like whatever, right? And so like all of these kind of developments in human politics and the terror of like human history, right, like are summed up in this kind of like useful framework of like what the state or whatever like power invests in your own personal life. And in the era, as you show in your book, and like one of the like amazing kind of like abilities of your book is the kind of like the way you juggle all these like different imperial histories, but also like these kind of phases, right? Because there are these like, there is this kind of like differing, there is this kind of evolution of imperial control over this like chunk of the world called Palestine, from the Ottomans to the Mandate period to the Zionist control now that we're in now. And like this is kind of like the terrain that Palestinian scholars like yourself are kind of forced to give up, or forced to sort of contend with, because these are three separate forms of control.
Yeah, there's even more, like we were talking about Jordanian, the legal, cultural, and they all coexist. You know, the 1936 the British criminal law, I forgot what it's called, but it took them forever to pass one in colonial Palestine. That one still applies. The emergency defense regulations for the 1936-39 revolt, Israel uses that. Right. There are like, yeah. So Jordanian laws also are one of the layers. And, you know, I'm very curious about Gaza sometimes, because it was under Egyptian rule. So what does that look like in terms of that adding that layer? But, and I wanted to say about biopolitics, you know, the way I talk about it, and I read I teach History Sexuality Volume 1 a lot, and the way I think about it is, it's like the state is concerned with who has sex with who and who marries who, and disease, you know, at the level of population and health and numbers of babies, and for a variety of reasons. But then the other issue about biopolitics is it exceeds the state. So it could be, it's the social worker, it's the priest, it's the NGOs, right? So it's an apparatus of concern that is managing and regulating. But see, since COVID, I have become a little less Foucauldian. And what do I mean by that? Because we saw, you know, the differences between states that cared about their people and ones that didn't. And I remember chatting with somebody about this in December, and there's a way that the idea of a state that, you know, that build some accountable forms of welfare structures and is accountable is somehow could fall through in a critical analysis. It could be condemned as part of a biopolitical project, but it you know, it's interesting. And that I think we need to make distinctions. I'm pretty anarchist in my, I'm like critical of states, I'm critical of institutions, but I just increasingly think we need structures. The question is, how accountable and democratic are they, especially to the least among them, and to difference, you know, within their societies? So, because I just don't think that in modernity that it's possible. But yeah, so that's our biopolitics.
When I use the phrase too, like, you know, this is not the fact that, like, you know, biopolitics was introduced to the most amount of people through Foucault, but he did not sort of like begin the, or coin it, or it was not his coinage, but it was something that preceded him. And also like the people, and generally the conversation has been, there's a lot of other people who have sort of picked up on the conversation, Agamben being one of the more prominent sort of like inheritors, whatever you want to say, but like popularizers. But at least for me, it's the deep investment in life and like the details of our life. Like this is also like Fitbits. Could you imagine if we like said to somebody, even in like the earliest 20th century, like, what's your BPM? Like they would laugh at you and be like, are you crazy? Like, do you, you have no time. You have so much time on your hands that you're counting your heartbeats and dividing them into minutes, because even like most of them didn't have watches to time 60 seconds. So they couldn't even get their BPM if they tried. And now we have our BPM at any second. We have it charted over the course of years of our own little life, you know, and God knows where that information is stored. God knows where that information is, like, you know what I mean? So like we are walking biopolitical subjects like every day of our lives.
But we're Borgish as well, right?
So yeah, that's true.
That combination of the human
human
and non-human. I mean, because I have a step counter, but it's on my phone. I refuse to have it on my watch.
Well, that's the surveillance economy too, working inside, like the surveillance of daily life has also drastically increased. Even in like 15 years, it's drastically increased, like off the charts. So like that, to take it back to like the Palestine question, think of the layers of control that Zionists and like their allies like enjoy over their Palestinian subjects. They, every single phone, every WhatsApp message, every blood test, every single, like every, God knows, every Fitbit is probably under, like they know where you're stepping. You know what I mean? Right. Every GPS, like we walk around. And that's also the same true with us here. Like we're not under subject of war. We're just subject to the rule of these like oligarchies, and they suck up our information for like, because information about our lives is ultimately what they want from us too. Like we're not like Palestinians aren't the only ones subject to biopolitical rule. It's just the nature of the war against Palestinians incorporated into the era of biopolitics is so interesting. Now, to get into your book, what's particularly interesting in your book is that you've collected in, I don't know how you did this, how you collected these stories, just like these people who are, I imagine some of them aren't around anymore also. Like you probably, like that's, that like these were, these, you did, you know, I said this off mic earlier, but like, you know, academic, like literary people, we like to talk about archaeology. We're like, oh, I'm doing this archaeology. Yeah, look at me. I'm brushing it away. You know, here's this dirt. I'm brushing it away. Look at me. I'm reading something that hasn't been read in 80 years. My God, look at my brush. It's so full of dirt. But like, you're actually doing archaeology, but like figurative archaeology. It's like your brush and like human archaeology in a sense, because these people were supposed to be buried under dirt. Like they were supposed to be. If like the Zionists had their way, they would be forgotten. And like you're going there and like extracting, I mean, extracting is an ugly word, but it's true. But like in the sense that like there's a story from these, from this, like from these, with 26, 28?
So what I'll tell you what I did. So what we haven't talked about is I'm also interested in what I call anti-reproductive desire. So the kind of second half of the book is about birth control, including abortion. And so what I did is I decided that I wanted to know, well, how, you know, what were the reproductive practices of women during, Palestinian women during the mandate? And I decided that, you know, when you actually did the math, age of marriage and things like that, that meant women born between 1918 and 1932, maybe 1933. And my logic was who had at least one child before the Nakba. And so, but then I tracked these, because of their ages, I tracked them through their childbearing in the 50s and the 60s. And so my logic there is, when I realized that child death was so central to Palestinian life and isn't a story that's told when you think about both Zionism and the British imperialism. So I ended up like just searching all, you know, in Jordan, Palestine, I went to Lebanon, and searching for women. And also the other thing is like practices like abortion were illegal. The British made them illegal. And so they were always going to, I interviewed OBGYNs and midwives and nurses of multiple generations. They were never going to be written down, or they would be coded as something else. So essentially it's a non-archival subject, right? So really through word of mouth, I found women. I ultimately found 26 women that met my criteria, and I just had them talk about their mothers and their own reproductive experiences. And I literally counted years between pregnancies and then asked how is it that somebody might be missing if it's more than 2 years? And sometimes there were infertility problems, but usually it's child death, and sometimes it was wanted abortions. And a lot of times it was just other birth control practices. And why they engaged in them, you know, what were their reasonings? Yeah, so some of these women have died since 2018, but all the interviews are recorded and I transcribed them, but I also returned them to them or their families if they wanted them. Right immediately after I conducted them. So what I do is I fold in like kind of more complete stories about Palestinian life and Palestinian death. And then the other piece, which I do, I went into this project, there's like a big political question, which is a demographic competition logic is totally part of the Zionist project, right? Like basically depopulating the land, populating it with Jews rather than Palestinians and Jewish Zionists, right? And so, but there's also this longstanding, as a feminist scholar, way in which it projected onto Palestinians, men and women, that they don't care about their children, that they don't care about their babies, that they put them before the tanks, and they don't value life, right? And then there's the other piece, which is that people have babies to demographically compete, right? Palestinians have babies to demographically compete with Israelis. And even though the population bomb. And even though I'm well, like, versed in, to some degree, not, I don't want to say well versed, but versed in the psychoanalytic literature, I decided to actually look at this empirically, although not completely, because in the end, I engaged with literature and film. But what I learned from this book, I think I bought into that after 48, there might have been a demographic logic to how Palestinians kind of lived and made decisions. But really, when I dug in, there was like no evidence for this. Right? You could make a psychoanalytic argument, but you actually couldn't make another kind of argument. And so what the book argues, or what I argue in chapter 6, is that, and there I both tore apart methodologically the demographic literature, like all of its problems, even the so-called sympathetic demography literature on Palestinians and their childbearing and birth control practices. But then I also went to things like some iconic film, you know, novels, poetry. And really what I found there is that first, what I found is this is a projection. It's Western and Zionist projection. They're the ones always obsessed with the race and not just in Palestine, you know, with race and class and who's having more babies and what does that mean for geopolitical power and our geopolitical power and imperialist power. But second, I found from looking at this literary work is that there's much more of the investment, the Palestinian investment after 1948 has been about a multi-generational struggle. It's the passing of struggle. And I found a lot of themes that were about death, not, you know, about truncated life. And also I deal with a couple of Mahmoud Darwish's poems, because there are some iconic poems like, oh, you know, I am an Arab, one of Darwish's earliest poems. So I kind of take that, write it down. And, but that gets used as evidence of a kind of competition. But then I sort of, well, first Darwish never had a child. And secondly, he talks about that poem. And third, I engage with some of his other poems. And I make an argument that actually death, but also social survival and rejuvenation and political through struggle is the major theme that you find in post-48 literary production and film and things like that. And then I use that chapter to push a bit more, using Afrofuturism and Afro-pessimism to think a bit more about what is Palestinian futurity and how does it include queer Palestinians, for example, or what does it do with the non-heteronormative, you know? So I did a lot of field work, you know, and usually what I would do, because for this, I worked on this book for about 5 years, you know, maybe six, if you include.
Yeah, the interviews are from 2018, right?
Yeah, but I kind of started in 2016, not those interviews, but just thinking about, and what I would do is I come like between semesters usually. So I had two semesters off during that time, but I also used to come at the end of semesters and between semesters for 5 weeks, 6 weeks. And then it just, And then it was people here who said, you have to talk to people. I was like, oh, really? How am I going to talk to people? So then it's actually word of mouth. But also I have a reputation for showing up in a refugee camp or showing up in a village and kind of looking for people. So I had, if you see in the book, not what I would say false starts, but people who were too young for my purposes, right? They'd be like, you're 75, you're too young. And they would laugh. They're 75, they were too young. And so, but I would often interview them because they wanted to be interviewed and fold them in, what they analyzed and what they knew folded into other parts of the book. They're not in the 26. So yeah, And then these are communities where people have relationships. I mean, I'm in Amman right now, in Jabal Amman, and people know each other. The businesses know each other. They know who lives in different houses. They know I'm around. They kind of watch out for me. Imagine, though, in a refugee camp, you know, a multi-generation or in a village. So I do that. And in refugee camps, you often, you know, you follow protocols. Like you go to where they run the UNRWA, the UN Relief Works Agency school, or go to the UNRWA Women's Committee office or something. You know, there's the women. There's always the women. You know, they run the camps. And so, and then they find people. And then also people don't always know their ages. That's the other funny thing, is just lying about ages, not for reasons that we would assume, but because, say, there was a marriage between a 13-year-old and an 18-year-old or a 20-year-old, and the government, the British government or the Jordanian government, or, you know, it says no. So then there were all these kinds of ways in which people trick. So that's also funny, like just figuring out, when were you born? And so it's elites that were the most likely to know, you know, exactly when they were born, right? So,
right, because they probably had the most, yeah, like right away.
The registration and then the other thing is that the British, you know, the midwife would, most people were born with midwives, not in hospitals, and the midwives would kind of gather there was a rule, you had to register the births, you know, the British had it. And so, but they would gather up maybe 6 months worth of births and then deliver them, you know, to the government, right? Like my dad has two birthdays that are like that.
I have that too, actually. Like I was born in a relatively remote corner of Iran and there was a war going on. So it took me a few days to get my birth registered. It's funny, you know, we have so much surveillance over life in this part of the world that like every life is tracked, and like it's like, I mean, I said this in my dissertation somewhere, like that, like a human life generates so much paper, a modern human life just generates an archive of texts even before they're born. Like reports, I mean, now it's all kilobytes, but like before you would have scans, you'd have reports, you have insurance documents, like one single little life, you know, probably actually your generation of people probably are the best because like this was, everybody had paper then and everybody, like there were modern hospitals and they kept records. And even if they were lost or whatever, like your life was like this paper giving object. And it still is to this day. Like there's an immense amount of, and then that's just your life. Forget your social existence, your school, your insurance, or all those things. Like it's just paper. So like, this is an interesting thing is that like pre-modern life was so untext that like the textuality was instead of textuality, they had, I guess I'm being romantic in saying this, but I feel like it's true that that kind of roots, a kind of like a rooted life of generations of people reproducing themselves and reproducing their way of life and inside their, of that. So like
the memories.
The memories and like, but also like the nature of human like reproducing, not just like an individual life like physically, but reproducing your own life through the form of like feeding yourself and whatever. It was relatively stable for a long time before the 19th and 20th century showed up and like ruptured our lives and like forced us to move to cities and whatever. And like, so like it's interesting that there are these vestiges in Palestine still of, I guess the people you're interviewing are from the mandatory period, all of them.
Yeah, but I have family and this is Bilad al-Sham I mean, what I want to do though is not like on the questions of reproduction and things like that. I mean, people die, most children die, you know, in the world. You know, like most people had more babies than survived because of limited resources, because of, you know, all over the world. But, you know, the 19th century is a real like turning point and in different like societies. But then the other thing is the medicalization, you know, the development of technologies and medicalization, which has positive, you know, it has positive outcomes for life, some, right? I mean, even something like discovering that, sewage, you know, the treatment of sewage would actually make a massive difference to the length of life, the most massive difference. And, you know, but you still are, a lot of refugee camps, the sewage is open sewage, not just in Palestine, but lots of other parts of the world. And so, so I don't want to romanticize those parts. I mean, the 19th, but The problem is the science and the technology came in with the agendas of modern states. And but one point I make in my book is that, you know, especially that chapter on law, is that Islam, that Islam is historically very flexible and multiple on those questions, you know, actually of bodily autonomy and integrity. It's very much a bodily autonomy and integrity. And Islam is closer to Judaism in terms of jurisprudence on those questions. So one thing about modern states is they're much more strict and conservative than actual living, you know, cultural kinds of histories and practices, but also fiqh, you know, Islamic jurisprudence and Sharia. So that's been something that I've negotiated in my like intellectual career, is that because sometimes, you know, Sina, in next year is the 100-year anniversary of the Ottoman Empire formally being ended. And when Bilad al-Sham was Bilad al-Sham, and complicated, and but you moved through it, and you know, diverse, always diverse, and what are the consequences of that kind of sovereignty within a imperial dominated world order, and what are the truncations that we all have suffered from these, you know, parts that are just violently separated? And in Palestine, you have it on just multiple micro scales when villages are separated from the heart of, you know, that's how it is. It's like a sun, you know, with rays. You know, the villages are long and winding. It's probably like that in Iran as well, many countries, but then there's always the city, and it's a relationship. And then when you cut that off through like this kind of racist Zionist structure, what does that mean? But then what does it mean to cut Lebanon off from northern, historic northern Palestine? Or what does it mean when crossing the Jordan River? So yeah, I'm thinking about these questions these days, or the northern border of Jordan in relation to Syria, things like that. Yeah.
Yeah, the partition of Bilad al-Sham and the subsequent colonization and of the region, and the imposition of Zionism. I mean, all these developments, yeah, Palestinians have felt as kind of like various waves of, you know, like forced from above put onto them. And like, and it's interesting, you know, the kinds of people you interview, right, they obviously, and because of their age and because of what society and like kind of what Palestinian society looked like back then, it's typically a heavily peasant society. So like, the thing is that like when we in English talk about like the peasantry, we're thinking of like European peasantry living in the north, right, who like brutal winters, you know, like that kind of like, and it's like a completely, and it makes me wonder, I was like, is it the fact that like the, what was like the life of like the peasant in, say, like Bilad al-Sham or like whatever you want, like West Asia, right, because of the softness of the weather, or the relatively like not as harshness of, say, like the northern climes. Like, I wonder, I was like, you know, was it like, if you could have found a way to like continue that life and not have like the violent sort of like effects, because, you know, I always wonder about this in terms, I guess there's a bigger question about how the Ottomans ran Palestine, and like and I guess Greater Syria was the province, right? And like how the Ottoman kind of conquest of that region, because, and then its shift for, and then the sort of like the sort of passing of the baton, like temporarily, to the Brits, and now the sort of like Zionists, who are, you know, like, because of the nature of where they come from, are a kind of mishmash of European, Euro, sort of American, projects, right? And so like this passing of the baton of imperial projects is interesting to think about and how it played out. And you wonder about like the sort of average peasant, you know, of today versus the peasants that you are, that you interviewed, and like how, what their lives were like and the relative stability of their lives and of their ancestors' lives versus the chaos of what today we would say is a Palestinian farmer, right? We wouldn't say peasant, because the peasant class, we know, like there's not that many peasants. Like that's, they've been conscripted into the capitalist machine, and we call them farmers or agriculture because of just how land works and just, you know, like that's just what happened, right? And so like the way that you provide a snapshot of this kind of, I mean, it's sad to say this, but dying historical era and economic era in a land that had been like, because think about it, like under Ottoman rule, people had been living this way. They had been for thousands of years prior, right? Peasantry is a pretty long process, and they showed that they were responsible like tenants of the land, right? The way that indigenous people here showed that too, that they responsibly took care of the land and passed it on to their, whereas, you know, like three generations of Zionists, you know, have left quite the mark. And the same thing goes with like, you know, Palestinian, with colonists here, white settlers colonists here, is that like the destruction of the earth, the rapid destruction of the earth coincided with their rule and the eradication of this class of people we call peasants. And so it must be interesting to sort of like, that for them, like they saw the world like go up, like they saw apocalypse and they like lived right through it, which is kind of what indigenous people did too, right here. But long ago, like much longer ago. I mean,
there's still class politics in Palestine, and there was then. You know, they're feudal relations, and there were, you know, there were droughts, right? There were. It's funny. Last weekend I was near the Jordan River. I went to a very old archaeological site on this side of the Jordan River called Tabgit Fahel, and there's like people from all Bilad al-Sham, but also Palestinians from 48 and from 67, but there hasn't been rain. And so I guess part of it is, I want to say, whether we call them peasants or farmers, that actually they're alive and well, you know, in the knowledges, and that's what struck me when it always strikes me in Palestine. It's in the food, it's in the culture, it's in the knowledge of weeds that we eat. You know, that I recognize this weekend. I was like, is that khubiz? And he said, yes. And then he pulled it out and he said, but see, the seeds are not supposed to be like this. And that's because we haven't had rain for a month. And that is, that's, you know, I still think that's there. Like I won't concede that it's not, because I see it everywhere. But all these things are insisting, I mean, all these systems and these projects are insisting on interrupting it. And of course, like the uprooting of olive trees is like,
it's a metaphor for colonization. Yeah, it is the best metaphor.
Yes, it's a metaphor. And then it's literal uprooting of decades of life for that tree, and then life-giving, like olives and oil and also shade and, you know, all kinds of things.
But it's interesting that like that olives are such a potent symbol for Palestinian resistance, because the way that you root them, the way that you can like unroot them, is that you can also like, nature is infinite in its giving, right? Like it doesn't, you just graft more and you plant them and you wait and you protect them. So like there is, there is this kind of like romanticization of the Palestinian and like kind of collapse with the olive tree. And like, I'm not Palestinian, so like, I'm not going to do that. But like, there is a very powerful, evocative image in ripping them up. However, is that the fact that they're still there, the fact that there still is olives being, there still is an olive oil industry, just proves that the Zionist project has failed in its goals, that we live in the aftermath of its failure, and that all of the like effort that goes into it all of the like extraness like that goes into it every day, the sort of like relentless marketing and promotion. This is what I talked about in my episode with Sadie, is that like that extra work, the labor, is just like proof that like it can't keep going on its own without all this like extra boost, without like 10,000-40,000 Ukrainian Jews making Aliyah, right? AKA colonizing. Like you needed other people to be ripped out of their homes to then help to like come and help you in the same project. And yet you have this other problem, which is like, are those Ukrainians going to get along with the Russians who already live there? Are they going to get along with like the New York, Brooklyn? Like, no, right? Like the same problems of making any society apply to Zionists. And so when what Palestinians provide them in the abstract is something to unite them against, which is crazy that their own disunity in their own project is partially rectified in the very existence of the Palestinian. Because you wonder, like, if they actually succeeded, if Palestinians said, okay, khalas, let's just give them what they want, let's go to Jordan, like, we'll set up lives there. Like, if they did that, then what, you'd have the same problem of all these, like, disparate entities from different places all being bribed to live in this place that's not necessarily their own, that's not in a lot of ways their own, and yet they're trying to, like, make it for their own, but they don't have roots. Their roots are somewhere else. I mean, the episode, there's this thing that Louis Alde told me that he heard from someone that the Hebrew ch, like they can't do ha the way that Arabs can do ha. So that's why they say Hamas, 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 even in Hebrew, because that ha is too hard for them. Even I as Iranian can do that ha that they can't, right? And I can do an ayin that like they probably couldn't. And yet all those years situated in that their own language, their Semitic language, is foreign to them because ultimately they're still European. That Europeanness, as much as they've tried, has not gone away. And the fact that like so many Zionists live part-time in the West is just like proof of that like the pull of their metropole, which is what it is, right? It's so strong. It's so absolutely strong that they need it, that the colony, as much as like they believe in their colony or claim to, that the pull of the metropole is so strong that they can't escape it. And so like, that's why you have like guys like Adam Newman and Ray, whatever, that guy from WeWork, right? This like, he was nothing in Israel. He was just some scum. He was just some idiot, right? Like trying to sell baby clothes. But in America, with that, like with whatever luck he had, or who knows what, I always think there's some kind of deep state involvement because nobody gets to be that big without a little bit of help. But like with that, like his project required an American real estate project to like continue, right? That like, that is like your typical average Israeli like economic project that requires these other countries to like give them, to like house them and aid them and provide their resources. And that's the same thing in sort of Zionist project as a whole, right? Like who, like food and weapons and technology and all these things, right? They come from abroad because they don't have roots. They gave up their roots. They went from Europe. I mean, some of them lost their roots, yes, in the Shoah. Yes, you can think that, yes, they lost their roots and they sought out new ones. But in that thinking, and which is always kind of like the nice side of the Nakba that people like to tell, which is to say that it's some sort of like bomb to the Holocaust, which is like absurd because on its face, you're doing it to other people. You're like kicking out, expelling, killing, murdering, raping, maiming, burying, you know, like mass graves, other people to like rectify your own trauma, which on its face is like palpably absurd. So this is an interesting thing that the subjects you found of your study, like can map these different eras of colonial control because they saw Zionism at its peak. Your subjects, yeah. They really did. They experienced it as being, and they survived it. That's yeah. What's interesting is that the survival.
And in fact, at least two of those 26 women survived massacres, meaning their husbands were killed in one in the Deir Yassin massacre and one, I forgot, Lidda, you know, a famous massacre. And I just wanted to say about Zionism that one thing I do in the chapter on eugenics is I show a long-standing interest of Jewish intellectuals, elites, right, by definition, in eugenicist projects I mean, this is like one of my interests, you know, and it's like,
because they were Europeans in the end, everybody got it on the phone.
Yeah. And so just the way in which we just use, like, you know, World War II and the devastations of the Holocaust and the rise of Nazism and fascism, you know, from the 20s, if you know, Italy and the rest of Europe in the 30s. And so, but I show using scholarship and primary sources that actually there's a strong eugenicist quality to Zionism, even in relation to Jews, and that it's a product of its different environments, because in Austria or London or Paris or all the places, and that there's a continuity, you know,
a racialization project. Yeah.
Yes. Including, of, you know, Jews who are from Iran and, from Iraq and Morocco and Egypt. And cause they're also, you know, part of the fabric and largely reactionary, you know, so yeah. So that's also a piece of the book that I track in one of the chapters. And things like breastfeeding, which I never knew was actually related to eugenicist, white supremacist projects. I mean, just internationally. And I have a whole section on that, like that babies are dying because they're not being nursed by their mothers, but it's white babies and it's elite babies. And this is having racial implications geopolitically, in the competition between nations and the competition between races. But then the way racism works, it's very flexible. You know, it's like capitalism. Then it's like, but then you have a discourse against Palestinian women for nursing babies until they're two, or it's just really funny. The very same thing is just defined in completely opposite ways depending on your ideological agenda, and I show some of that in the book, you know, using primary sources, archival sources.
Thank you so much, Frances. This was a great conversation. What are you working on next?
Well, I'm working on this like feminist theory and imperialism thing, thinking it through with my colleague Anna Krylova, who's a historian of the Soviet Union. And I'm thinking I have something coming out on Egypt, on anti-torture, feminist psychological group of leftists that has worked for over 30 years on questions of torture. So that's coming out in the fall in the journal Signs. And I'm on Twitter and I have a website.
Thank you so much, Frances. I'm going to press stop.
Yes.